TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. The day we bombed Utah. Between 1951 and 1992, a total of 1,021 nuclear bombs were exploded on the Nevada test site. On July 17, 1962, the test shot of Little Fellow 1 became the last atmospheric test detonation at the site. Underground testing of weapons continued until September 23, 1992. The test area is pockmarked with deep craters, a testimony to the fact that many of the underground tests broke the surface of the Earth and vented radioactivity. Residents around the Nevada test site were encouraged to watch the mushroom clouds. They did not know, and were not warned, that the fallout from these clouds carried life-threatening radiation. Some downwinders kept their handbooks issued by the Atomic Energy Commission. The book stated that fallout was safe, and the worst thing to do was to be worried about it. In Part 1, John G. Fuller took us to the high desert of Nevada, close to the border with Utah. On March 24, 1953, the first direct proof to the public of the deadly nature of nuclear radiation was affecting sheep herders from Utah. They spent the winter on the range near the Lincoln Mine in Nevada. Kern and Mac Bullock were rounding up the herd to drive them to Cedar City, Utah, where the sheep were going to give birth to the next generation. You heard in Part 1 of The Day We Bombed Utah how the March 1953 detonation of a nuclear device called Nancy showered the area with nuclear fallout, and some of that fallout drifted as far as Troy, New York. When the Bullocks finally arrived at the lambing sheds in Cedar City, a majority of their and other sheep herders' ewes gave birth to deformed and stillborn lambs, and then over 4,390 of the adult sheep died with symptoms never seen before. The Atomic Energy Commission sent veterinarians who verbally mentioned to the locals that this was radiation damage. However, their reports disappeared. Some of them recanted that radiation was the cause, and other AEC officials outright lied, then and later in court. Declassified documents show that the AEC knew right away that the sheep died from ingesting radioactive fallout from the ground, along with their forage of sagebrush and grasses. One of the reasons why the AEC decided to lie about the risk of radiation might have been the effect on human beings in the downwind area. They were hit really hard 5 weeks later on May 19, 1953. On that day, an even more powerful test shot named Harry, later known as Dirty Harry, lit up the whole sky, and the cloud of radioactive debris covered the town of St. George for 2 hours. Even though the AEC publicly denied any relationship between the deaths of the sheep and radiation, matters looked differently behind the scenes during that summer of 1953. John Fuller wrote in The Day We Bombed Utah, "Summer 1953, in Washington, D.C., Los Alamos, New Mexico, and Hanford, Washington. Letters, phone calls, visits, and classified documents began to reflect panic on the part of the Atomic Energy Commission's upper echelons. If radiation was the cause of these massive damages, what would happen to the testing program? How many millions of dollars of other claims would come in? What about public furor?" In January 1954, the AEC issued a public statement, the culmination of an 8-month whitewash intended to rule out radiation damage. It eliminated all the incriminating evidence that had appeared in earlier drafts. Statistics on the sheep deaths had been deleted. A report admitting the conclusions of the experts were far from unanimous had been cut. When Utah health officials complained that they had not concurred in the report, The wording was changed to read that they had reviewed the report. The statement was released on January 16, 1954. The general public was unaware of these elaborate internal maneuvers. AEC press releases painted an optimistic picture. But the sheep ranchers couldn't understand why they weren't being reimbursed for their devastating losses, which had by now amounted to nearly $250,000. Some ranchers would go out of the sheep business forever. Others would sell everything they had at a horrendous loss. Some would be paying off debts for more than 3 decades. 3 days before the report was issued, Pearson, Trum, and several other AEC men met the ranchers in the Cedar City firehouse. Minutes of that meeting suggest that it was a somber event. The AEC men gave all the reasons why radiation could not have been the cause. The sheepmen were not impressed. Mac Bullock said, "We were told we were in a hot spot on the range." An AEC man answered, "This has been a wonderful opportunity for us to evaluate the actual damage done with a fallout. You can't cause a big amount of damage with a small fallout." End quote. To the sheepmen, this and other statements were a lot of double talk. They listened further as Dr. Leo Bustad told them about a comparative study of his experimental lab sheep and those of the Utah sheep. He had fed the lab sheep massive doses of radioiodine and concluded, "The Utah sheep showed no evidence of the radiation damage observed in experimentally treated sheep." End quote. But this was directly contrary to fact. Dr. Bustad failed to tell his firehouse audience that his laboratory sheep exhibited almost exactly the same symptoms as the Utah sheep. To reveal this would be to admit that radiation was the cause. Dan Bushnell, a fiery and determined young Salt Lake City lawyer, was following the case and he was angry. Although he knew nothing of the backstage antics of the AEC, he smelled something wrong. To him, there was evidence of radiation damage and of extraordinary suffering because of it. He filed suit in 1955. The AEC did everything possible to block his pre-trial discovery process. But Trum and Pearson were concerned about the hidden conclusions of Veenstra and Tomsett as the trial date approached. John Fuller then describes exactly how the AEC staff scientists who had initially diagnosed radiation poisoning were forced to change their reports. Other scientists were ordered to give false testimony in court. The case in 1956 was brilliantly argued by attorney Dan Bushnell, but he could not fully penetrate the secret and classified screen set up by the AEC. Its experts all took the stand and testified that radiation had nothing to do with the cause of deaths, absolutely nothing. Federal Judge A. Sherman Christensen, himself unaware of what had gone on behind the AEC scenes, could not believe that a group of scientific experts would possibly cover up for the government. He put the question to Dan Bushnell in court. "Do you want me to believe that they aren't giving their best considered objective opinion with reference to the effects, if any, of radiation?" Bushnell stood before the bench and spoke clearly, "I do." Although the AEC was unable to come up with any reasonable alternative to radiation damage, the judge had to go with the scientific evidence displayed in the courtroom. The highest level of fallout could not possibly cause this damage, the experts contended. Judge Christensen entered a tortured and troubled judgment in favor of the government against the sheepmen. The numb and nearly bankrupt owners did not appeal. But the tragedy was not limited to sheep. There was a nightmarish aftermath. Slowly and almost imperceptibly, the horror spread. It was reflected not only in towns like Cedar City and St. George, but in Washington, D.C., too. President Eisenhower, worried about public concern, sent the AEC a directive in the mid-50s. Keep the public confused as to fission and fusion. End quote. At a February 23, 1955 AEC meeting, the commissioners discussed wind direction. There was almost nowhere a fallout cloud from Yucca Flat could drift safely. When someone suggested east, Strauss said, "No, east they go over Pioche and St. George, which they apparently always plaster." Strauss was right. St. George was always being plastered. And shortly after these concerns were being expressed, and at about the same time the sheepherders were presenting their case in court, in 1956, 15-year-old Colleen Hafen became desperately ill in St. George. Her mother took her to the hospital in Salt Lake City, but there was little that could be done. The diagnosis was acute myelogenous leukemia. Brought back home to St. George, she lingered. One day, as she lay on the living room couch, she called her mother. "Mama," she said, "please call the doctor. I'm going to die." Her mother said, "You're not going to do any such thing." Colleen said, "Yes, I am, mother. This room is just full of angels." She closed her eyes. Her mother called the doctor and took her to the local hospital. They worked on her for 3 hours. She was dead. 9 years after that, Mrs. Hafen's husband died of cancer. Later, she made a chilling discovery. There were 5 houses on her block. 7 of her neighbors had died of cancer. 2 had undergone cancer surgery. Others in St. George began to make the same sort of observation. Irma Thomas noticed that 29 people within a 1-block radius of her home on Tabernacle Street had been afflicted with leukemia or cancer, and 8 of them had died. Prior to this, St. George had reported one of the lowest cancer rates in the country. In 1960, Elmer Pickett, owner of a St. George hardware store, and the man who once had stood on Sugarloaf to watch the blasts, took his 38-year-old wife to Salt Lake City Hospital. The diagnosis was lymphosarcoma and Hodgkin's disease, and later leukemia. She was dead in 7 months. The radiologist said to Pickett, "I don't know what's happening in St. George, but we're deluged with leukemia victims. We've had practically no cases before this from there." Pickett, in a state of shock, counted the members of his close family who had recently died of cancer or leukemia. They totaled 11. As widespread apprehension grew in St. George, Arthur Bruhn saw the fruition of a labor of love. The final construction of the new campus of Dixie College, which he headed, was completed in 1963. He too had watched the tests in the pre-dawn chill, warmed by mugs of hot chocolate. Now, a decade later, on a short vacation out in the nearby Pine Valley Mountains, he and Lorna noticed an inordinate number of claim stakes of uranium prospectors. The Geiger readings were high, with the counters going off almost everywhere they were set down. But the hopes of the uranium prospectors were futile. The Geiger counter did not indicate potential uranium mines. It meant radiation fallout. It was accumulated fallout from 1,000 kilotons of blasts of upshot knothole and other tests conducted up to 1963. Total domestic detonations were the equivalent of 77 Hiroshimas. Just before Christmas in 1963, Arthur Bruhn complained of a headache, and he thought he was coming down with a flu. He wasn't. His face and skin became yellow and drawn. A blood test showed acute lymphatic leukemia. He died on July 5, 1964, at the age of 48. His wife, in her bereavement, did something she had never done before. she began reading the obituary columns. In the months that followed, a terrifying awareness grew within her and the other townspeople of St. George. Several of her husband's friends were dying of leukemia. A highway patrolman who had worked at the numerous roadblocks was one of them. Another was a friend who had worked at a service station, washing radioactivity from the cars with his bare hands. In the early 60s, little was heard from the AEC, soon to be split into the Department of Energy and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Nor was much mention made of accumulated plutonium fallout, one of the world's deadliest poisons, with its half-life of 24,000 years. There was evidence that an increase in plutonium-239 had been found in the lungs of Utah deer, and that the herds were disappearing. Government officials still insisted that the levels of radiation exposure were totally inadequate to cause the havoc. They did so even when a 1979 joint congressional hearing in Salt Lake City uncovered more grisly details of the deception and fraud that had been going on since 1953. It was at this point that Harold Knapp was called to the hearings to testify on his radioiodine findings and discovered for the first time the details of the Cedar City Rancher's sheep deaths 26 years earlier. It all seemed obvious after the hidden documents had been declassified and sorted out. Knapp told a subsequent hearing at Las Vegas, "I will try to be brief. The sheep ate enough fallout to kill them. That is the simple explanation." When the 1979 congressional hearings revealed clear evidence of fraud and cover-up, the AEC became more vulnerable than ever. In May 1982, Attorney Bushnell reopened his case in the Federal District Court on the grounds that a new trial could be granted when outright fraud could be proved. Judge Christensen, now 77 years old, called for such a trial in an unprecedented legal move. Bullock et al. Versus the United States moved into a new phase with the same attorney and judge who had begun the action 30 years before. The government, the judge concluded in anger, had perpetrated a fraud upon the court. The judge stated that the conduct of the government agents was intentionally false and deceptive. On the heels of this decision, a new and different trial opened in the same federal court at the end of 1982 under Judge Bruce Jenkins. It is an action brought by more than 1,100 cancer and leukemia victims from the affected tri-state area. St. George residents were confident that the facts were strong enough to prevail in court. For years, Irma Thomas collected data and wrote to doctors, scientists, senators, and congressmen. She felt that her work had contributed to exposing the government cover-up. Elizabeth Boone Wright, daughter of Arthur Boone, who died in St. George in 1964, felt the same way. When her father was dying, he said to his daughter, "Someday they will prove that the radioactivity caused this, and you must promise me that if ever you can do anything to prevent other families from suffering what we have, you will." And that is where the story by John G. Fuller ends in the article he wrote for Omni Magazine in May 1983. The suit brought before Judge Bruce Jenkins was successful at first. The official website of the Utah state government has an extraordinarily candid account of that legal battle. It reads, "The Downwinders filed their case, Allen versus the United States, before Federal Judge Bruce Jenkins in Salt Lake City in August 1979. They had hired a team of attorneys to sue the AEC, headed by Stuart Udall, a former congressman and former Secretary of the Interior. By the time the case came to trial in September 1982, Ronald Reagan sat in the White House, and Henry Gill, attorney for the Department of Energy, took the lead in presenting the government's defense. Not surprisingly, Gill and his team based their defense on the plea that the AEC had acted within the scope of its legal discretion under the FTCA. The Federal Tort Claims Act of 1946 allowed people to recover compensation for damages caused by the willful or negligent acts of government employees. Under this line of argument, the Department of Energy said officials at the Nevada test site had no duty to warn the public of the dangers of the atomic tests. After hearing the arguments and testimony, Judge Jenkins in May 1984 nevertheless ruled in favor of the suffering downwinders. In a 489-page opinion, Jenkins emphasized that, quote, "A time-honored rule of law imposes a duty on everyone to avoid acts dangerous to the lives of others," end quote. Jenkins argued that, although the AEC knew or suspected the risk from the fallout, they publicly lied about the danger, and they carried on a propaganda campaign that downplayed the probability of such deadly diseases. Jenkins ruled that the fallout had probably caused the cancers in 10 of the plaintiffs, and he dismissed the claims of 14 others. After hearing Judge Jenkins' opinion, Stuart Udall urged the Reagan administration to accept the decision and pay for the negligence of the AEC employees. Instead, Reagan's attorneys appealed. In a replay of the Bullock sheep cases, the 10th Circuit Court became the downwinders' graveyard of justice. Overturning Judge Jenkins' opinion, the Circuit Court judges ruled that this method of conducting the tests and the decision not to inform the maimed and dying downwinders were policy judgments protected by the discretionary rule of the FTCA. In 1988, the downwinders lost in the court of last resort as the U.S. Supreme Court refused to review the Circuit Court decision. In the meantime, people sickened and died from leukemia and cancer. Finally, the downwinders turned to Congress for help, largely because of the work of Utah Senator Orrin Hatch and Congressman Wayne Owens. Congress passed and President George Bush approved the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act in 1990. The government apologized to the victims for the irresponsible behavior of managers at the Nevada test site and established a trust fund to pay for some of the injuries. The impressive number of potential victims and long list of diseases written into the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act is a heart-wrenching testimony to the dangers of radiation and a timely reminder what may come of nuclear power accidents and even routine operations. However, the amount of money offered is paltry in relation to the suffering and financial damage of those who not only lost their children, parents, and friends, but often incurred medical bills into the hundreds of thousands. Not just the downwinders, but huge additional groups of people were included under the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act, making it obvious that many stages of the nuclear fuel cycle are deadly. Specifically mentioned are Navajo uranium miners, test site workers, military servicemen forced to watch the tests, and downwind victims of radiation-caused cancers. They can be eligible for the following compensation: $50,000 to individuals residing or working downwind of the Nevada test site, $75,000 for workers participating in atmospheric nuclear weapons tests, $100,000 for uranium miners, millers, and ore transporters. And the list of cancers that are covered under the Radiation Exposure Compensation Program is impressive. Bile ducts, bladder, brain, breast, both male and female, colon, rectal, esophagus, gallbladder, most leukemias and liver cancers, lung, multiple myeloma, nasal pharynx, lymphomas, ovary, pancreas, salivary gland, small intestine, stomach, and thyroid. And this list should be placed before anybody participating in today's new efforts to engage in uranium mining and exploration, considering starting up nuclear testing or licensing of nuclear power plants. The first new nuclear power plant in the U.S. in over 30 years won approval February 9, 2012, as federal regulators voted 4-1 to grant a license to Southern Company for two new reactors at a site in eastern Georgia, south of Atlanta. The NRC last approved construction of a nuclear plant in 1978, a year before a partial meltdown of the Three Mile Island nuclear plant in Pennsylvania. After that accident, fears of a radiation release were heightened and new reactor orders nearly were brought to a halt. A great testimony to the power of the anti-nuclear movement at that time. That was the conclusion and update of John G. Fuller's article in Omni Magazine, The Day We Bombed Utah. Thanks to RT at KPFK Los Angeles for providing the copy of this very hard-to-find text. This goes out with love and respect to all those who have contributed to life without nuclear in all its forms, weapons, electric power, industrial uses, and even medicine. You can hear this program again on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. You can also find links to the sources used in updating the story. And you can even hear the voices of some of the downwinders, including the late sheepman Kern Bullock, on the Swedish Public Radio website, swedishpublicradio.com, under Dirty Harry. You can get information on how to order a CD of the reading of John G. Fuller's The Day We Bombed Utah by calling 1-707-463-2654, and I will repeat that number in a moment. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation keeps this program on the air. Call anytime at 707-463-2654 for information on how to order. You can get your CD by mail or credit card by phone or online on TUC Radio's secure website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.